Morning. My name is Fred Niedner, and the title of this session is The Risen Christ of the Café Boeuf. I will explain the meaning of that title momentarily, but let us begin first with a word of prayer. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe. You have given us the gift of a new day of life. We ask that in this day you guide us in all that we say and do, that we might be your faithful servants, that we might rejoice in the creation and the people you have given us as your gifts. Be with us as we study your word, that we might find comfort, hope, and a challenge to live faithfully. In Jesus' name, amen. If you go into the St. Martin's Resource Room, across the hall here, at some point while you're at Holden and look at the Holden mission statement, you will find that one of the things in the Holden mission statement is that things are done here, among other things, in a spirit of hilarity. And so I am not always certain that hilarity will happen during the main part of a Bible study, so I make sure that it happens at least once at the beginning. So I always begin with at least something that's designed to be a bit humorous, and so today I brought along a few pieces from my rather large collection of children's letters to God, most of which I've received as gifts over the years, and this particular group is from a book put together by a man named David Heller, who teaches at Harvard University and solicited a whole lot of children's letters to God, and among them got these, which he's collected in a volume called Dear God, What Religion Were the Dinosaurs? Dear God, how long did it really take you to make the first people? Do you feel you rushed too much? Obviously someone who's noticed some flaws. That was from Keith, age 10. Dear Big G, hi out there. I have only one request, more rights for 9-year-olds. I'm sick of hearing, wait till you're 10. From George, age 9. Dear God, what country has produced the most angels? How are we doing? Celeste, age 7. Dear Great One, now that I am 10, I want to have a talk with you, please. I am just about a whole decade. And you may not believe this, but I have never been water skiing. I think it is time. Tell my dad to loosen up. Love, Cheryl, age 10. Dear God, why are grandparents so much nicer than parents? Is it their experience, or is it that they just give up being mean? That was from Jamie, age 12. Dear Lord, thanks for the bike last Christmas. It has made me very happy, except for May 13th at 4 o'clock when I rode into a big ditch that I did not see. I am okay now. From Spencer, age 10. Dear God, what happens if you do a few bad things and say you're sorry, but are not sure if you really are? Does it matter if you are only 10? From Jan, age 10. Dear God, I am taught to love my neighbors, but some days I find it hard. Please help me to love old Mrs. Creighton, even if she is a crab. Raymond, age 10. Dear God, my mother and father honk for Jesus and cars that are in the way, too. Love and Sweet Thoughts, Sherry T., age 8. In a different vein, dear God, my grandfather died this year, as you know. I felt very sad. Maybe you did not know. My grandfather likes ice cream a lot. Please make sure he is taken care of. Your friend Ian, age 6. And finally, dear God, I am a boy. You need to know that to help. My girlfriend Fran is 1 year older than me. Do you think that's okay? P.S. Her mom does not know about us. Thank you, Brian, age 8. Well, okay. Risen Christ at the Café Boeuf. I chose that title partly because I figured it would get at least some people's attention, regardless of what we were going to study. But there is a meaning to it. Many of you know that Café Boeuf is a fictional place invented by Garrison Keillor in his Prairie Home Companion radio show on National Public Radio on Saturday afternoons or evenings. And it's a different place than all of his other places. The rest of all his sponsors and his fictional establishments in the mythical existence of Lake Wobegon are all in Lake Wobegon. Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, if you can't find it at Ralph's, you can probably do without it. That's right there in Lake Wobegon, as are the Sidetrack Tap and the Chatterbox Cafe and the Fearmonger's Shop and Bertha's Kitty Boutique, and all his other sponsors are right there in Lake Wobegon, and you have to get there in order to go to them. But the Café Boeuf is everywhere. He takes his show on the road, and no matter what town or city he takes that to, there is always a Café Boeuf Duluth or a Café Boeuf San Francisco, and it's always right around the corner from where the theater is. And so no matter where you are, you can't not go to the Café Boeuf and be with the maitre d' Maurice and be insulted because you don't know French. Well, the point of the stories we want to study, or I will look at with you today, is that no matter where you go, you can't not be with the risen Christ. And so if you will, we can always go to the Café Boeuf and have the meal, a foretaste of the feast to come with the risen Christ. All four of the New Testament Gospels had to answer a question for themselves, or that is for the early Christian community as well as for outsiders, and that question was this: you people say that Jesus is risen from the dead, okay, well, where is he? And what is he doing? Where is this risen one whom you confess? The Gospels had to try to do this with narrative. Other kinds of literature could attempt to explain that in other ways, even though most of them end up doing it more or less poetically, regardless of how propositionally they might attempt this. But the Gospels had to do it in narrative, and each one has its own way of doing this. And two of the four do it by means of stories that involve food. And so I decided that we would look at Luke's and John's stories of appearances of the risen Jesus, because those involve food. There are some Bibles around the room. You might want to grab one if you don't yet have one. And please turn to Luke chapter 24. Now, the part of Luke 24 that we are most centrally interested in is the Emmaus story in verses 13 and following, and though it's a bit long, I think we'll go through it anyway and familiarize ourselves with all the pieces of it, and then go back and try to pick up what are the answers to this question: where is the risen Jesus? And what is he doing? Let me say in advance, any time you want to ask a question, comment, please feel free to do so. You don't need to wait for me to say, okay, let's stop a moment and discuss. On this same day, the first day of the week when the women have found the tomb empty, two of the disciples were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, talking with each other as they walked about all the things that happened. Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. In all three of the Gospels that actually have empty tomb appearance stories, Mark being the exception, there is this strange phenomenon that you can be with Jesus and not recognize him. You can, as we'll see in John, you can be with Jesus and know who he is and at the same time not know and wish you could ask. There is also a certain freedom in these stories that Jesus has from the normal boundaries of space and time, so he can appear in various locations without apparent benefit of the need for locomotion, and so forth. And so here is an instance in which something keeps the disciples from recognizing who Jesus is as he walks with them. He asks them what they're discussing, and they stood still looking sad, and one answers, whose name was Cleopas, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place here, there, in these days?" He asked, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified. We had hoped, though, that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it's now the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us at the tomb this morning. They did not find the body. They came back and told us they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Some of those who went with us went to the tomb and found it, as the women said, but didn't see him. Then Jesus, then he, said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had declared. Wasn't it necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village where they were headed, he walked ahead as if he would continue on, but they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us. It's almost evening. The day is nearly over.' He went in to stay. When at table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 and their companions gathered together." And we'll move on from there a little bit later. Well, where is the risen Jesus, and what is he doing? The first answer from this story is he can be right with you, or you can be right with him, and you won't know it. You can be in the presence of the risen Lord and be unaware of that. So you could be with the risen Lord anytime. Then the question becomes, how do you recognize the presence of the risen Lord with you? And the most obvious answer is in the breaking of the bread. The description of the meal is a description of a ritual portion of the meal, the taking of the bread, the blessing of it, and the breaking of it. The ritual portions that we have described for us in several other settings, most specifically in the Last Supper. There is also language like this, however, in some of the feeding of the multitude stories, where Jesus takes the bread and blesses it and breaks it and as he distributes it, then the multitudes are fed. And so somehow in the ritual of this sharing of the meal, these eyes kept previously from recognizing him are open, and they now can see and recognize the risen Christ. So he can be with you, you can be with him anywhere at any time and not know it, but he can be revealed to you in the ritual sharing of this bread. Now, in the commentaries, you get a lot of discussion. Is this meant to be a Eucharistic meal? Or is it any fellowship meal? I don't want to get into that. I think the point is that in any meal that you share, when you share bread that you bless and give thanks for in this way, together with other people, specifically in the fellowship of those who are seeking to be in the presence of Jesus, that's going to happen. He will be present in the meals that you have, in the fellowship of the community. There he will be. Secondarily, then, they realize that they had heartburn even before dinner. And that something about this experience of recognition began a bit earlier on as he had opened up the scriptures for them. This is a big theme in Luke's gospel, the opening up of the scriptures to see in them the necessity of the suffering of the Messiah. This was, of course, a major scandal, a stumbling block that the Christian community had to deal with, a suffering Messiah. A few of you who were here for sessions I led last week, we talked about this rather directly, the problem that all the messianic dreams of the, or at least all the ones that were popular in Jesus' day, did not call for a suffering Messiah, but rather they called for a Messiah who was going to really change the world so there would be no more hunger and there would be no more danger and, for goodness sake, there would be no more Romans. And here the Christians were now saying the Messiah has come. Jesus began the Messianic age. Never mind that we're still under the oppression of the Romans. And people are being slaughtered daily, and hunger is as bad as it ever was. The Messiah has come, and most, at least Jewish people, said, "You're nuts. You know, look at the promises. They haven't been kept. That can't be the Messiah." And so it was critical that the early Christian community be able to go back to the scriptural tradition and demonstrate that it can only be a suffering Messiah that would bring on the Messianic age. And so Luke never tells us in the times that he describes this happening that Jesus would open the scriptures for people to be able to see in Moses and all the prophets the necessity of a suffering Messiah. And I suppose it's important that he doesn't tell us, okay, here are the texts that you go back to. But rather, he gives us a hermeneutical charge, as it were, an interpretive command. Go back there to Moses and all the prophets and start looking for the necessity of a suffering Messiah. It's the only way it could work. As we know, when they went back, they found some things rather obviously. What are the first texts that might come to your mind? Where would you go first if you wanted to find the necessity of a suffering Messiah back there in the Hebrew Scriptures?
I
Okay, the servant poems of Isaiah that culminate with the great suffering servant poem of Isaiah 53. The servant who comes who will not crush the smoldering wick and break the bruised reed, but the gentle Messiah who will eventually take on the sins of the world or the suffering of the world. Where else might you go? Or where else did they go? Psalm 22. Mark and Matthew in particular, and John to some extent as well, describe the whole suffering of Jesus as a very similar to thing that happens to whoever prayed Psalm 22 originally, and Jesus dies then in Matthew and Mark praying those words. So there are some obvious texts you could find evidence of setting the world right or involving suffering. But if you take the invitation to go back and look almost anywhere for this and use this as warrant to dig that kind of stuff up, you can find it all over the place. And the longer you look, the more you can find, if you choose to, that the question was not whether ultimately God was going to have to pay the price of suffering in order to set the world right, but when and how it would happen. Because ultimately the pain of God and the grief of God, the suffering of God, begins almost from the beginning. At least as early as Genesis 6, when God looks around to see the condition that the world is in, and the narrator says God was grieved in God's heart and repented of having made the human beings because what was going on was so awful. And in that story, of course, God chooses to handle that by destroying everyone, saving one family to try to start over. And at the end of the story, in Genesis 8, 22 and following, God takes a look around and says, well, that didn't work. Destruction does not help. I will never do that again. And so that means God is stuck with all that grief and suffering. If there's going to be human beings, God is going to pay for it. So you can go back to the very beginning and begin to find that whatever it's going to take to mend the human community is going to involve suffering, at least on God's part. And many other places you can find it if you go looking for it. Well, Luke connects that experience to the revelatory moment of this meal at which, after the burning that they began to experience in studying the scriptures or hearing the scriptures opened, they then have the ritual meal and recognize Jesus. Now, as Lutheran person, I can say, well, see what we have here. We have the word and sacraments. And it is. I mean, that's what we have here. We have the revelation of our Lord brought to us, made clear to us in the breaking of the bread and in the study of the scripture and the opening up of it for us. So that's one element of this. The other one that's in this story is in the way that Cleopas and his friend identify this fellow who's walking with them back in verse 18. Are you, they ask, the only stranger in Jerusalem who hasn't seen this all yet or understood this all yet. So to them, he is not just some unknown fellow. He bears the label stranger. And so it is a stranger that they invite into their home for dinner and to spend the night. So on top of everything else, this is a hospitality meal. This is a meal in which the stranger that they invited in off the street turns out to be the one in whom they see the risen Christ. And so in that regard, this story can be connected up, at least to some extent, with stories like the judgment scene in Matthew 25, where you see the judge, where you see the one, the Son of Man, the one the reader understands as Christ, is in the person that you feed, though you didn't know that's who it was. Or the person that you visit in prison, though you didn't know that's who it was. So, at another level here, we have the revelation of Christ coming not just in the sacramental meal and in the study of the scriptures, but in the hospitality that you show to the one to who is to you a stranger at the beginning. Okay, questions so far?
Just one observation. You talked about the way in which the interpretation of Scripture and their heart burning, but it was the first dawning recognition that they were in the presence of Christ, and that only becomes clearly manifested down later with the breaking of bread. But is it important to notice the order of recognition in the narration, which begins with their recognizing him suddenly as he's there, present to them in the bread, but there in their midst, and then it's only when he vanishes from their sight that they then have that other discovery? Is this a kind of model for what the early Christians who did witness Jesus? It's the moment he vanishes what they then discover subsequent to that. It's his very vanishing that leads them to see that he's there in the Word.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Our colleague, Gail Eifrig, has done a lot of work on the importance that he vanishes. You know, it's necessary also, not just that he appears to them, but it's necessary, too, that he vanishes. And that this does not somehow become something you expect to keep. But rather, this vanishing turns you back on another quest. And it's important then that they go chasing after him into the scriptures and into town and into the arms of the rest of the community.
There's similarity to what we've often talked about as our mountaintop experiences. And we go to camps like this, and then we go back down in the valley.
So you could have this experience up here.
You know, the wonderful presence of Christ here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but there must be the disappearing.
Yeah, I think most of us would have a sense of that. That, I mean, most of us were here last night for Eucharist. I mean, this was surely one of those moments for me last night. You know, and I suppose halfway back across Montana, never mind, I don't want to. Montana's a beautiful place. It'll probably happen back in Indiana.
And then we can look for it again, back in our own.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And we can find it again.
There is one more piece of, anything else on that? There's one more piece of food in Luke 24 here that isn't quite as directly connected to the theme, but it is a kind of a bridge to another meal story that we'll look at, though, in John. When they're all back in Jerusalem sharing stories of how he has appeared to them, suddenly Jesus stands among them in verse 36 and says to them, "Peace be with you." They're startled and terrified and think that they're seeing a ghost, which is all very curious because they have now been with him and they're sharing stories of having seen him and having great joy, and all of a sudden he's there again and they're terrified, you know. So there's this going back and forth between being at peace and not being at peace, and recognizing and not recognizing Jesus. And this time he says to them, "Why are you frightened, and why do doubts rise in your hearts? Look at my hands and feet, that it's I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost doesn't have flesh and bones." And he showed them his hands and feet. Manuscripts don't have verse 40, so we won't dwell on that. John makes a big point of the fact that the hands and the feet still have those wounds in them in the Thomas story. So the fact that even risen from the dead, he still has, as Frederick Buechner calls them, these eternally ruined hands. That's a very rich thing to begin to think about, that the risen Christ has these eternally ruined hands, and that's the embrace you are always in. And so it was that kind of embrace into which Thomas was invited. But in Luke here, we don't so much pause on the wounds as on something else about Jesus' humanity. While they're still in their joy, disbelieving and wondering, Jesus said to them, "You got anything to eat?" You know, it is late after all. You know, 7 miles back into Jerusalem after dinner, and then they have this other conversation. So we're into midnight or after. You know, Jesus is hungry in the middle of the night, and we all know what that's like. So they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. Now, as I like to tell my students back in Valparaiso, none of these lines are throwaways. There wasn't room in these texts to just slip in little tidbits that had no purpose. So this little detail must be important for something, that Jesus asked for a snack in the middle of the night and they found some fish lying around somewhere. And so most commentaries explain this as evidence that Luke was fighting against a notion that became the first genuine Christian heresy, namely that Jesus hadn't been truly human, that he had been a divine character of some kind who'd come from some realm, took on the appearance of a human being, and when finished with the tasks he meant to accomplish, he then returned to this other realm and gave up the appearance of humanity. That heresy is known as docetism, from the Greek word dokeo, which means to appear or to seem. And so this is commonly understood as an attempt to say that Jesus is fully human, and even after the resurrection, the humanity of Jesus is still to be understood as genuine and intact. Obviously, this is not... They do not understand his person and his body as still exactly the same as others, because he can vanish and whatever. I mean, that's the description. But his humanity is still real. But this fish meal launches us into the next story, which is John 21. Another place where you can run into Jesus when you wouldn't expect to.
That hits me about the story is that this fullest of revelations of the risen Christ in the Gospel of Luke happens outside of Jerusalem, sort of in a could be anywhere town. Away from where you might expect a great revelation would happen. I think that fits with the Cafe Book idea.
That
Emmaus is any place.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that these two disciples are not among the 11 now, I guess, at this time. So they aren't even the big name disciples.
Yeah.
And the partner of Cleopas isn't named, which I don't know what you think of this, but in my mind leaves open the possibility that this is a woman.
A married couple. Or Cleopas, we don't even know if that's male or female name, I don't think.
We mostly assume it's male.
Yeah.
And most of the scholars say he's with his son, who later becomes a bishop of Jerusalem. So I think, why?
Yes.
Does he have to become a bishop? But anyway, there is that sort of anyone, any place, any time setting.
Yeah. Yeah, those are excellent points. Yeah, that this is the Cafe Boeuf Emmaus off there in right, only 7 miles from Lake Wobegon. Very good. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Does this also mean you went to eat walleye fight in heaven?
No.
Let's just kind of bring up, I mean, I think when people read this, they you kind of wonder, you know, what are we going to be like after the resurrection? Are we going to be like this? Are we going to be hungry at midnight? How do you deal with that? I've always thought this is often unusual. The reason was Lord, but what would you do to be hungry?
Yeah.
Maybe wasn't.
That's a very interesting and important question, and I am tempted to launch into something that would take a half hour, but I think we'd probably all agree that if we took this to its logical conclusion, we would finally be able, or we would finally come to the conclusion that heaven is a place we wouldn't want to go. Because, you know, if we still got to live with all of our wounds, and we're still going to get munchies in the middle of the night, I mean, what's changed? I used to not want to go to heaven because I didn't want to sing and play a harp forever. But if we got this too, you know, because I was going to take a banjo. But Luke is doing a risky thing here. He is taking the risk of giving that impression, namely that we will. He lets us be tempted to think that this other existence after resurrection has complete analogy to current existence. That it's completely analogous. One of my teachers taught me to say, or taught me to see, that when an author or a narrator, such as a gospel narrator, takes that big a risk and says something that is so dangerous that it maybe should have been left out because it might be interpreted wrongly, that narrator was working on a problem that was so great he couldn't not deal with it. He had to say something. And so this threat, I mean, if it is indeed the issue that people said Jesus hadn't been really human, Luke must have thought that was such a great danger that needed to be addressed, even though addressing it had its own dangers. So. All right, John 21. has another fish story. Fishing story. John 21 looks like a kind of secondary and unnecessary ending. The Gospel of John could have ended very easily with chapter 20. Mary Magdalene finds the tomb empty, goes and tells Simon Peter and the other disciple, who race out to the tomb. And like all other competitions in the Gospel of John, Peter loses. And in any case, they find the tomb, sure enough, empty. Mary Magdalene has the first recognition scene with Jesus, and she too can be with him and not know it. She converses with him. She sees him. It's not until he names her, speaks her name, that she recognizes who he is. Some connect that to baptism, in the same way that Luke's meal can be connected to the Lord's Supper. Then Jesus appears to the disciples as a group, except for Thomas. He breathes on them. This is John's Pentecost. He gives them the Holy Spirit. He charges them to go out into the world and to forgive sins. This is all a part of where is the risen Lord and what is he doing in John. He has breathed his spirit upon the community, and he is now active in their work of forgiving sins. John has taken care of much of the business of where Jesus is and what he's doing early on. In the prayers at the Last Supper, he tells them such, or in the discourses, he tells them such things as chapter 14, I'm going to a place to prepare for you, in my Father's house are many mansions, and so forth. But there is still more about all that. And after the perfectly satisfactory conclusion of chapter 20, which ends with saying Jesus did a whole lot of other things that aren't written here, but these are written so that you will believe and have life in Jesus' name, we kind of start over again. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, which is a name given to the Sea of Galilee by the Romans in the second century. He showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana, the sons of Zebedee, and two others. John speaks of the 12, but he only names seven. And here are seven. Only three of them actually named, two of them referred to as the sons of Zebedee, and two others. So we have seven disciples here. And Peter says, I'm going fishing. They said, we'll go too. They went out and got into the boat, and that night caught nothing. I'm not going to get into this here, but this business of Peter deciding after all this to go fishing has been interpreted in numerous ways. Among them, some older commentaries refer to this as Peter's apostasy. You know, as though, okay, this is over, back to my other life. but as we'll see, Peter's former work, fishing, it will really remain his work. And we've seen the metaphor for understanding this early on in Luke's gospel, where there is a very similar story. Let's look at the next paragraph. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach. The disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So again, there's this seeing but not realizing who you're with. Jesus said to them, children, have you no fish? Or you have no fish, have you? They said, no. He said, cast the net on the right side of the boat, you'll find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. The disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, ha ha ha, that's the only way Peter ever finds anything out. It's the Lord. Well, when Simon Peter heard it was the Lord, he put on some clothes, for he was naked, and he jumped into the sea. which sounds like a strange order, in which to do things, except that, you know, they do work virtually naked on the boat, and to go off and talk to somebody, he would be more polite to put a little clothes on and slosh through the water. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish. They weren't far from land, only 100 yards off. Let's kind of finish, then we'll go back and see what this fishing is about. When they'd gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said, "Bring some of the fish that you've caught." So Simon Peter went aboard, hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said, "Come have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" Because they knew it was the Lord. Well, why'd they want to ask? You know, so there's this, I don't know. I know who you are. Who are you? Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. First of all, the fishing story is parallel to Luke 5, where it is, in that gospel, the occasion for the calling of the disciples. He finds this group of people fishing unsuccessfully, tells them another way to do this, which would have, at least according to the commentaries, seemed foolish to them, but they did it and it worked. And then he says, "If you think that's something, come with me and I will make you fishers of people." And that becomes then one of the metaphors for discipleship and for the mission of the group of disciples. Discipleship as hauling God's dragnet of promise through the world and collecting everything you can. So this is not Peter's apostasy. This is Peter now going out doing a transformed version of the work he had always done. And it doesn't work unless Jesus is directing it. So one of the answers to the question, where is Jesus and what is he doing? Well, he has breathed his spirit into the disciples, and he is now active in the direction of their mission. And if he isn't, it doesn't work. Their mission will only succeed if Jesus has got a part in it. But then we have this meal. Notice that Jesus has cooked breakfast for them, and there's fish on the grill before they ever get there. He does not rely solely on what they catch for nourishing them. He feeds. He nourishes and sustains the people on their mission. So that's yet another piece of where is he and what is he doing? Directing the mission of the disciples, nourishing them and sustaining them, feeding them on the way. But this little breakfast on the seashore is a foretaste of the feast to come. Because here again we have some of the ritual language. Jesus took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. You would find the same language in another fish and bread story that you all know. The only miracle story that's in all four Gospels is the feeding of the 5,000 with fish and bread, where Jesus takes the bread and blesses it and gives it to them, and the same with the fish, and it feeds the multitude. It feeds the world. And so you have a little ritual fish and bread meal here, and so it's not coincidence that in some, especially Eastern iconography, you find pictures of the Last Supper with seven disciples, not 12, and with fish as part of the meal. So they have taken, in that Eastern iconography, they have taken all these meals, the Passover meal, the feeding of the 5,000, and this meal, and they've combined, and they've brought all these meals together as an image of the Messianic banquet. So we can say that in our work of hauling God's dragnet of promise through the world, we can count on nourishment and sustenance from the risen Christ as we share the meal that we do together in that mission. There's one other piece of this I told you there's no throwaways. Well, why do we have to know that there were exactly 153 fish and not just a whole slew of them? If you have a Bible with notes, you probably have something like I have here. My Bible says, scholars have noted that the number 153 is the sum of all the numbers from 1 through 17. To which my response is, so what? Although, you know, I have also seen that you can put all bunch of dots on a triangle. You know, 153 dots makes a perfect triangle. It begins to become like 666, you know. I've figured out a way to make Fred Needner come out 666. But the best note I ever saw on this was in, I forgot what commentary, but one of the commentaries on John refers to the early church theologian Jerome, who was, among other things, a Bible translator. And he makes a note in one of his discussions of John that he was told by someone once that the Galilean fishing crews had counted up 153 different species of fish that they caught. Now, if that's the case, that would make a marvelous point. You know, there's room enough in this net for every conceivable kind, and the net's not going to break. So don't worry. Don't worry about a weird-looking one that you catch someday. The net will hold. Okay?
It's written in a time also when numbers still have mystical qualities.
Oh, sure.
Of their own.
Oh, sure.
In Pythagorean or other sorts of...
Yeah. And Jewish, Gematrian was... Or the Gematria, the mystical value of numbers was already highly developed by this time. So there likely are other ways to look at that 153. But. Well, any other comments or questions? Or yes?
I can't resist this because I remember I preached on this about, I don't know, 2 months ago, was it? Something like that, when this text came.
Yeah, it's in Series C.
I was reading through a commentary, and they listed all the different theories about what this 153 meant. And I don't know if this is exactly right, but I think one of them said it was 100 for the men, 50 for the women, and 3 for all the virgins. And this person had 15 different theories that had been come up to what the 153 was. that this commentator had found throughout the centuries.
And that was allegedly an ancient interpretation?
Yeah, that was some, well, I don't know how ancient, it was like 3rd or 4th century. I don't know, I don't have it exactly right, but
yeah.
Those three groups.
Maybe the world won't come to an end until we have 153 theories about
it. I'm sorry to distract.
No. Then again, you just could stop with chapter 20. You know? Well, tomorrow we're going to look at eschatological feasts on mountains, except the title is Dining Below the Holy Mountain, because in most of the visions of the dinner on the Holy Mountain, there's always somebody down at the bottom. Not up here eating fat things with the rest of us. So we'll figure out where we'll have dinner tomorrow, on or below the mountain. Thank you.